back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively, at least I'm positively, out of Taharka ice cream here on the set. I got my my Honey Graham. I have a little bit of this left in the freezer, but I'm going to be making my trip back out to Taharka.com. And made here in Baltimore, they ship it to you. They are our great sponsors of Baltimore Positive and all we do. And Don Mola's taking that to heart. He's trying to gain 15 pounds over there in Catonsville when he's not up at State Fair. Tell everybody what's going on at State Fair, because I know you were up there. There's a big outdoor area. We're 6 feet away, and they're opening a Mexican restaurant, right?
It's amazing. Great things going up in Catonsville. They put up a huge tent so you can social distance and get all that State Fair food. They are the State Fair restaurant group, Evan Brown, Keith Holsey, opening up a new Mexican restaurant across the street in the near future.
Are they calling that Nestor's? Have they figured? Have they got a name for that yet?
I don't know what they're going to call it. Okay. I know that that our guest, I've actually run into our guest at State Fair there on Sunday brunch. And I think you approved, did you not, Barry?
I did. It was quite good. In fact, we are frequent flyers, at least we were before the shutdown.
Well, Don, I know you guys know each other well. I'm going to let you take the floor here on this one because it's such a rich background, and all of us have the background of Baltimore, Baltimore County. And you know, I only participated in the Parks and Recs. I didn't, you know, I didn't run them.
Well, it is a pleasure to welcome to Baltimore Positive Barry Williams. Barry, the longtime Baltimore County educator, Baltimore City educator, former principal of Randallstown High School, and then area superintendent in Baltimore City, and then ended up working for many years as in Baltimore County, first as the director of workforce development, and then as the director of recreation parks. So Barry has had a wide range of experiences, and as we do this deep dive on Baltimore Positive into race in America, I can't think of anyone better to really talk about all the aspects of what's happening in our nation than Mr. Barry Williams. Barry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, Nestor.
Well, we've been at this a little while and trying to talk about all sorts of things and making Baltimore better and Baltimore Positive. And, you know, we've talked about the election and the results and all of that stuff. But mm-hmm. I think more than anything, when Don and I got together to do this thing, we thought we'd be talking about Baltimore and Baltimore issues and fixing the play. I didn't know we'd have protests, you know, up and down the streets again. I'd hope we'd seen the end of that with Freddie Gray. Certainly COVID came along and all of these things. But the psychological move of this country, I would say, over the last 90 to 100 days, I don't know that any of us have seen anything like this. And I think it's changed our conversations in a lot of ways. And certainly this week, the conversation has come to race and our city and making things better.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting. For the people that really were anti-Colin Kaepernick and never wanted to understand why he kneeled and wanted to make it about the flag and being against the troops and things like that, I'm hearing more and more folks that are coming around and saying, okay, now I get it. And so for me, even though the protests have come back, they largely, certainly in the Baltimore area, they've been largely peaceful. Those who wanted to try to start something, they've been shut down by the peaceful folks who have been demonstrating. So I'm buoyed by that. I'm buoyed by folks who are opening their eyes and listening more and getting that. And said, really, you know, we get the peace now that Black Lives Matter, because I can't tell you the number of times when I would see Black Lives Matter and then I'd come back with no, Blue Lives Matter or All Lives Matter. And what's wrong with you? And if you don't agree with me, then you're not a patriot. So I'm seeing more of a shift in that. And to that, this is one of those, you know, sometimes we have to hit the bottom before we can rise, and I'm hoping we're rising right now.
Well, Barry, I woke up this morning at 5:30 in the morning, and I'm, you know, brushing my teeth and checking my Twitter and looking, and Ed Reed screaming at Drew Brees, right? I mean, you know, and we talk mm-hmm. about the NFL and my background in sports, and I know you love sports as well, and we mm-hmm. all do. We all love sport. All love the Ravens, right?
Yep.
And Drew Brees in New Orleans in the midst of this. Takes the argument back 5 years, and I've shared the picture, and Don knows about this. I was over in London. I took a knee at Wembley Station literally that uh-huh. morning and put the picture up, and
I remember that.
Hell raised down. Well, thank you very much. I didn't realize you followed me at that level. Hell raised down on me. I lost sponsors, and you're uh-huh. this, and you're that, and I, hey, man, you know, My father came here from Venezuela. I'm an immigrant. What I've seen recently, the people in cages look like me. And I think all of us have had a turn on where we need to be in November at the election. But between here and there and the NFL and sports and black and white, we look for sports to be a leader in all of this. But again, when I wake up and there's Hall of Famer Ed Reed from New Orleans screaming at Hall of Famer Drew Brees, and Brees is clearly on the wrong side of this topic, but so were 32 other NFL owners a couple years ago. I do find it fascinating, Colin Kaepernick, as a topic here this week, because certainly at every rec and park and every school, Colin Kaepernick has become this objectified thing over 3 years. He's a real guy, and when you take it back and review back to the press conference where he's at his locker, there's nothing he said at his locker that that we wouldn't all agree with this morning, I wouldn't think, right?
Right, absolutely. No, I mean, I'm glad that people are re-looking at their stance on Colin, and you know, and he knelt very respectfully. He did it in a way that was not inflammatory, but he wanted to make a point. He wanted to draw attention to all of the African Americans who are mistreated, and let the rest of the nation know that, you know, no, we are not one nation under God equally. So,
and you know, the interesting thing, Nestor and Ben, I read to you this morning the Breeze thing, and what I was struck by was how complicated these issues are. And what I mean by that is, by all accounts, Drew Brees is an incredibly good person and a philanthropic person who has given millions to make his community better. And within what got lost in the discussion back and forth here, and it's so hard, I think, to have these discussions, the way I read it was Drew Brees even had knelt down with his teammates before, outside of the anthem. In other words, knelt down prior to the anthem and then stood for the anthem. And Brees was saying, I support the cause that Kaepernick's talking about. I support the idea that we need to recognize that Black Lives Matter. I just think we need to separate it from connecting it to the anthem of the flag. People can agree or disagree, but I think it's healthy that we try to have the discussions. And as you said, Nestor, it's not easy to have them in these emotional times because...
Well, I go back, I had Nate Boyer on. I've had all these football players on. I walked locker by locker in Wembley after they lost whatever, 41-0 or whatever it was that day, and talked to some of the African-American players who took the knee and let them know that I had supported them. But I also, the next day, got on the radio and I got on the Twitter thing and I heard it all about being disrespectful to America, and there was no oxygen for that. I think both of you would agree. There was no oxygen on the room on ESPN, anywhere, the Fox affiliates, the people that own the league, Robert Kraft, Shad Khan, who gave somehow $1 million to Donald Trump. If you were against that, you weren't marching with Donald Trump. Hey, I was on a passport over in London, man. I was on a subway, right?
Well, don't forget, too, and you and I, Nestor, have had this discussion with Dick Cass and Kevin Byrne. We've talked about it several times, is that the whole taking the knee thing, too, had become pretty much of a non-issue until this president, you know, the apprentice himself, decided that it would be a way to get his base cranked up. And all of a sudden, what was really...
It was an Alabama hate rally, wasn't it? Isn't that the genesis?
It was a dog whistle is what it was. And
exactly.
He energized his base. And then I'm telling you, it was so divisive. And certainly most of the African American athletes who may not have thought that much about it, when he raised that hue and cry, then they all wanted to take a knee. I don't blame them on that.
Correct. Exactly. He incited both sides. Again, we're with longtime Baltimore County, Baltimore City educator Barry Williams, more recently director of Workforce Development, Baltimore County, director of Rec and Parks. Barry, you wear so many hats to this discussion as we're trying to have a real honest discussion about race. You grew up in Baltimore County, in Arbutus, the Cannonsville
in the 1960s. And I think, you know, in the arc of history, the 1960s aren't that long ago. I wonder if you can paint a picture for our listeners of what it was like to be a young African-American growing up in a predominantly white school system at that time. What was it like for the Williams family?
Well, let me share with you. So we grew up in a community that has been a long-time historically African-American community. My family can date back to, like, the 1820s. That's how far we can go back. And they were freed slaves during that time, or freedmen. I don't even know if they were slaves, but they were freedmen. And going on back, my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, and my two greats were all born in that general area that was known then as Cowdensville, but we generalize it right now for Arbutus. Remember when Brown versus Board of Education, that happened in, 1955? 54. So it was only a few years after that that I started school at Arbutus Elementary. And I will share with you that I used to tell folks that I went to integrated schools. And upon reflection, as an adult, I looked back and said, no, I did not go to integrated schools. I went to legally desegregated schools because I was the only African-American in my first grade. There was one other in the second grade. There was one other in the fifth grade. In all the other grades, I was the only African-American in my class. So that was not integration. That was what I would call legal desegregation. There were so few of us. And I went to high school at Lansdowne High School. And although we had a large class, there were only 8 African-Americans in my class of like 446 or something like that there. So certainly I got a good education. I met some very terrific teachers and some wonderful classmates. But there were times when it was very apparent to me that, you know, I was part of the other, and there were certain areas that I should not go to. And I remember when the 68 riots happened and how very careful people were around me. And I remember walking down Sulphur Spring Road, and a policeman stopped me. Now, this is in my own neighborhood. A policeman stopped me and asked me what I was doing. I said, I'm just walking to my grandparents' house, and they wanted to know where. And so it was really just a kind of a harassment. He didn't detain me, you know, but it was just kind of like, well, why are you out here? What are you doing? And again, this is in my own neighborhood. So all of us had episodes. When I say all of us, all of my siblings and the neighbors, the few neighbors that we had, all had those kinds of incidents. I remember something that Adrian and I later shared, that when we started school at Arbutus Elementary, I remember both of us having had the best square dance teacher, which was the best square dance partner, which was our teacher, because at that time they did not think it was appropriate for a little black child to hold hands with a little white child.
And from what year is this, Barry?
I started school in 59.
Okay. 59, so I think it's not that long ago. And
no.
Help us then, Barry, because my goodness, certainly on social media and in articles all across the nation, particularly for the last 2 to 3 weeks, folks are trying to come to grips with this idea of white privilege and what it is. And when folks say to you, Barry, can you tell me what you mean by white privilege? I mean, I'm thinking when you talk there about the square dance thing or being stopped in your neighborhood, I'm thinking there's something that the white child that grew up in Arbutus, he's looking at you and going, what? I didn't know about that. I mean, to me, I think of that as trying to get a handle on this white privilege thing. But what do you say to folks when you try to explain what white privilege is and why it's important for us to understand it?
Well, it's important for folks to understand it so that they have a real grip on what real equality is, and the things that we take for granted, or you may take for granted, other folks cannot. I and my wife raised two African-American young men, you know, whom, you know, we had to have the talk with them. And, you know, we are very fortunate. We provided for them as much as we could. But the reality is, there but for the grace of God, could either one of my sons have ended up, you know, like tragically some of the other, Trayvon Martins and other folks. The talk was to, even though you may be right, I'd rather have them think that, you know, you're going to go along rather than be dead. And so there's, you gain nothing by trying to prove to a policeman, if you're stuck, that you were in the right, because, you know, bad things can happen. So when you are driving, you put your hands on the dashboard so people can see that you're not trying to do something untoward the policeman. So you always pull over when there is a bright light so people can see you, the things that you are doing, that you are respectful when you are pulled over. And don't, you know, even though they may try, someone may try to bait you into an argument, you know, don't take the bait. Just comply, give your license, give your registration, do what you have to do. Those were the things that, you know, we've had to, you know, tell our sons when they were starting to drive. But I will share with you, my one son, Patrick, and I were, and he was about 8 years old, and we were going one of the strip malls someplace, and it was actually in Howard County. And we were walking by and through, and my son said to me, "Dad, I don't think they like us here." And I tell you, that broke my heart, because I thought, you know, I didn't think I needed to have the talk with him until later on. And here he was at eight, sensing that people were looking at us as if we were intruders, as if we didn't belong. And he sensed that. So it's those kinds of things, not having to always consider the promotion that you did not get was based on, you know, your own merit or not. And those, so many things that always have to come into play. I remember going into a drugstore, and if the cashier, you know, is particularly unpleasant, not knowing whether or not they're unpleasant because, one, they're having a bad day, or two, you know, I represent someone that they are not fond of, and therefore this is how they think is okay to treat someone. I mean, there's a whole list of things that people just don't have to think about if you are not an African-American. You just go through life thinking this is how things are. And actually, for African-Americans, it is not. Things are better. Let me quickly say things are better, but still, things are not at an equitable point.
Well, Barry, continue with that, because, I mean, I can just see Nestor's mind racing, and we sit and we listen and we're trying to walk in these shoes. I want you then to take us through the next part of your journey. You've done a wonderful job of capturing it as a parent. Now you're a principal. You're at Randallstown High School, and you're trying to have, you know that the kids at Randallstown have tremendous talents and abilities, and you're trying to make the staff recognize that as well. Talk to us about being an educator in a predominantly African-American school and what you were trying to teach and what you were learning, actually, as an adult.
Well, Don, certainly you know this, that when I went to Randallstown, the superintendent at the time was Stuart Berger.
And I've met him.
right, okay.
Hey, Don'll tell you, Barry, you know this. I love iconoclasts.
He is all that and more. And, you know, I'm actually happen to be very fond of him. He asked me to take Randallstown, but Randallstown at had fired its most recent principal. You know, the school was in a turmoil. There were fires. There were a whole lot of things. And the place just looked like hell. He asked me if I would take it. He kept up in the ante by saying, okay, I'll allow you to zero base the staff, the teachers. And I said, what about the staff? He said, well, the staff too. I said, what about the APs? And he said, well, the APs. And so, you know, I kept on asking for more and more things just because I knew it was going to be a monumental task to try to bring the school around.
It's like you can never get enough pitching, right? Literally, when you're running a school, you can never get enough resources, right?
Right. Because if you don't get it, at the beginning, good luck on any other thing. So, and he was real good. He agreed to the things that I asked of him. What I found there that there were such low expectations on the part of a lot of the staff, including many of the African-American staff that were on there as well. And so I think all total, there was like 37 teachers that I removed and three out of the four APs there because they may have been pleasant folks, but they were not going to be moving in the direction that I knew that Randallstown needed to go. And so, they left. I hired, their equivalent and three APs. Fortunately, the APs that I got were seasoned folks who came in. But it was a big task because we had to deal with attitudes not only in the school, but also attitudes in the community. I can't tell you the number of meetings that I had in the community, meeting in people's homes with black and white parents who had questions, who wanted to know, is this place going to be safe and what are your plans? And they wanted to make guarantees. And I said, the only thing I can guarantee is that I'm going to do all that I can to try to make this better. What it's going to look like, all I certainly hope is going to be better. And, certainly with a lot of very good people and a lot of hard work and a lot of support, we were able to make some great strides at that school. And so our attendance went up from, I don't know, it was like 80 maybe. We went up to 95%, which I was ecstatic about. There was the fights and the fires, they all went away. And I remember community members thinking that, well, you're not going to be able to achieve that. And we did, because we set the bar high, give folks the opportunity and share with them how they can reach that bar and how they can be better. And it's not playing down to them by keeping the bar high for them, but being very supportive of them. And things, certainly went the way that the students needed to have it go. So, and Don knows this, Nestor, but things went so well that for the class of 97, I invited Colin Powell to be our keynote speaker. And he agreed. So that was our big plus. And the reason why I wanted him, I didn't want a sports figure. I didn't want an entertainer. I wanted someone who had worked hard and achieved well. So, and as I, in my introduction to him, I said, I wanted to give our students the best of the people that are out there. And I can think of no one better than to have Colin Powell come and address your class, and words to that effect. So it was a great opportunity, certainly for me, but certainly for the students. And I'm still receiving lots of attaboy kind of things from my former students and staff there. So that was a great experience, but it required a lot of effort, and it was all worth it, because certainly that's why we got into education. We wanted to make a difference for our students.
Barry Williams is our guest. I'm sorry, Barry. Here on Baltimore Positive, Don Mohler, of course, from a Baltimore County executive. These guys know each other well as educators. And, of course, Barry ran Parks and Recreation, amongst other things, director working in county government along with Don Mohler, director of workforce development, all this stuff. I want to go back. I've never told this story. I want to throw it to you two because you're my senior elders. And, Barry, I don't know if you know, Don was my high school guidance counselor in 1982 at Dundalk High. I met Don on the first day of high school. It was before orientation. They didn't put me in the journalism class, and my parents were beside them. I needed to be a journalist. I was going to go be Oscar Madison, right, or John Steadman. Mm-hmm. And I went down, and Don got me in my journalism class. So this is 1982. Don, I don't know that I've ever shared this with you, and I've been thinking a lot about my childhood and music, and I've been writing a whole bunch of stuff out on Facebook and whatnot, and I actually remembered the Penguins at East Point Mall from the early 70s and told my wife, and I put it out on the internet. Everybody remembers the Penguins at East Point Mall, but nobody has a picture. But in Dundalk in the 70s, I went to Colgate Elementary, which Johnny O's rebuilding, which we love that. I went to Hollabird mm-hmm. Middle, then it was a junior high school. It was the worst experience of my life. It was just mm-hmm. terrible. I mean, I was a high-achieving kid with a bunch of people that didn't like high-achieving kids. Right. And I got to Dundalk in 79, 80, and 81, my neighborhood, which is Colgate. If you would have asked me at Memorial Stadium, if you would have met me as a child, 77, 78 at Memorial Stadium, said, "Where do you live?" I would have said, "I live in Essex. I live near East Point Mall. I'm from Essex." "Well, why are you from Essex?" "Well, every big brother and sister I know in the neighborhood, they all go to Kenwood. That's where they went. Everybody went to Kenwood. All my mother went to Kenwood. My stepbrother, everybody in the neighborhood went to Kenwood." About 78, 79, word started coming that they were going to rezone. And our neighborhood, that by the time I get there, I'm going to go to Dundalk. Well, you can imagine Archie Bunker's Colgate, okay? Now, I've got elementary school pictures. Kindergarten, first grade, second grade, I skipped third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. There's not an African-American in any of my pictures. There's one mm-hmm. Asian child that I grew up with who was Korean, who was very different than anybody else because their parents didn't speak English. And this is 1977, 78, 79. And at that time, the movement from Kenwood to Dundalk was perceived, there are black people there, right? They're from Turner Station. And this is 1978, 79. And I remember there was a May Day, May 1st. Everybody was going to riot. It was whites against blacks, and it was on the sides of walls. This is 1980, 81. And my parents and everybody in the neighborhood, because it's all white neighborhood, freaked out. You're going to go to Kenwood. You're not going to go to... I don't know what there were no riots. I don't know what got involved. There was no internet. There was no Twitter, no Twitch, no 4chan, none of that nonsense going on at that time like there is today. But I went to Dundalk, and when I went, I can't imagine, Don, in 1982 at an assembly, you taking a microphone and even mentioning anything about race or black or white or how we all need to get along. I walked into Dundalk High School, and for the first time in my life, I had African American wrestling on my wrestling team in my classes and places, and I never had a problem. Maybe I was just sort of raised the right way, but and I didn't hear so much of it in 1982, 83, 84. But Don, I remember 3 years before that, and I don't know that I've ever talked about this 40 years later, that how much consternation there was about race in Archie Bunker's Colgate in 1978, 79, wow. and 80, and the fact that you couldn't, and Barry, you being an African-American, if you were the AP or wherever you were, I don't know, and we had African-American teachers and like all that, but I don't know that we ever really sat down at the race, religion, politics. We didn't talk about that, and teachers didn't talk to kids about that, right?
Esther, I'm going to tell you, and Barry, I'm sure, I can't see him if we were in person like we'd like to be, and we will be mm-hmm. again. I guarantee you that Barry is smiling because the two educators here are about to tell you, and Barry wasn't working at Dundalk High at that time, but he was, I don't know which school you were at that time, Barry, but Nestor, working on race relations, this is fascinating, and this is mm-hmm. the kind of discussion that we wanted to have.
Well, it took me 40 years
working
to bring it up with you.
On race relations at Dundalk High School took all of our energy at that time, and you are saying that to you, you didn't even notice.
Oh, I was chasing girls and worried about whether the Orioles were going to win, and how the Colts were doing then,
It makes me smile in the sense that says that some of the work we were doing over there, I mean, Barry, you remember well, Dunbar Brooks, Edie Brooks, the Pat family. I mean, these are legendary folks from Turner's who were working hard with us.
Oh, my God, the Pack family. I'm friends with half the family on Facebook.
Well, remember now, Nestor, as we had this discussion, what you just alluded to, that when students came to Dundalk High, half of that student body came from Holabird, where the first African-American they ever saw, in most cases, was now there, who came from Dundalk Middle. So the first really melding of the cultures for many of those kids took place at 14 or 15 years old. So there was a lot of work going on behind the scenes. Where were you, Barry, back in the 80s in terms of your
In the early 80s, I was working at the Alternative Center in Catonsville. And then in 88, I went to staff development with Roger and Sue. Roger, I can't think of his last name.
Well, you know the work then at staff development. You know the work you were doing on equity then.
Yeah. And remember Dr. Steve Jones, of course, and all the work that he did. And, you know, I mean, I was a part of his team of going out and going into communities for a long time. So, yeah, there was, so Don's point is there was a lot of work going on behind the scenes in the communities that wanted to make things go well. And Nestor, to your point that, hey, listen, you know, generally the kids just got along because they realized that kids were kids. Yeah, but there was a lot of preparation for that. I dare say when I first started in the 50s, they weren't quite sure what kind of training. In fact, I know that there was no training that was really involved. You just put African Americans into schools. Now they legally desegregated, and that was it. There was no attempt to try to do anything special. And I was blessed to have some really good teachers. And I learned a lot of things from those who were not and who were not as sensitive. So,
Barry, when you look to the future, you got children, you got grandchildren. When you look down the road 10, 15, 20 years in the United States of America and race, I mean, we're all right now turning on the TV every night. We've got, you know, I go from being optimistic to pessimistic when I see what's happening. I mean, certainly nothing more pessimistic than seeing African Americans being murdered while they're jogging by guys in pickup trucks and police officer putting a knee on a young man's throat and suffocating him to death. But then I see all kinds of red, black, white, blue people coming together, short, tall, all kinds of shapes to say, hey, this has to be a moment in history. When you process it all, Barry, not only just as an American, as a human being, but certainly as an African-American, are you optimistic looking out 15 or 20 years, or are you pessimistic?
No, I I'm always, you know, glasses half full kind of a guy anyway, but, you know, knowing the things that I've gone through and knowing the history, and Don, you and I are both kind of history buffs and, you know, certainly studied extensively the civil rights times. And I remember when I was a small child walking home from Arbutus Elementary, and unfortunately too many times, not every day, but we'd be walking along in the street and somebody in a car would, you know, roll the window down and try to spit at us and, you know, those kind of things. So that's the point of reference that I have of, you know, have we gone as far as we need to go? Of course not. Have we made a lot of strides? Yes. And so for my grandchildren, I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime. For my grandchildren, I really want them to have the kind of freedom that your grandchildren have, Don, to, you know, to get about, execute the world and, you know, not have to think about things. And, you know, I still, you know, and going into new places, you know, I will look around to see, are we the only African Americans? Is this a safe place? Is this a good place, you know, for me? You know, I like to travel, but before I travel, I always want to check the temperature. You know, well, is this a
Barry,
place
was,
that I'm going to feel comfortable?
I was telling Nestor the other day, and I apologize for jumping in, but you made me think about it when you said travel. When the film Green Book came out, so many of us were fascinated, and as you said, I consider myself a bit of a history buff, and I was totally unfamiliar with the Green Book, and I remember you and I were in the executive conference room of the, I can remember exactly where the conversation took place. We were in there for a meeting, and I said, "Hey, Barry, I saw the movie Green Book." And you said, "Oh, I remember it well. I remember my family using the Green Book." And I thought, holy mackerel. Tell our listeners, Barry, who can't remember what the Green Book was, they may have seen the film, but tell them your experience with it as a family.
Well, we traveled from Baltimore down to Virginia and sometimes down to North Carolina to visit other family. But the Green Book was the place that we knew that we could stop for either food or gasoline and that we'd be well received. The reality was the further south you went, the less likely you're going to find a spot, a convenient gas station or a convenience store or a restaurant that you could go to and feel safe. And so that Green Book was around for years. I think it probably outdated itself in the 70s, it was a handy tool for any African-American family that wanted to travel, and it covered just about the entire USA.
All this, you have such a successful family. You, your sister, your brothers. What was it in the Williams? I mean, I'm trying to think to myself, riding home, this is the white privilege thing again. I'm trying to think.
Yeah, nobody spit on me. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I'm riding my bike home. Now, again, I always look back and said, I'm sure people said, don't hang with those older kids, because my mother was a single mom, divorced. We lived in an apartment. So I'm sure we were the kids on the other side of the tracks. I was just too dumb to know it. But had I been riding my bike down Frederick Road to come back to my apartment, and people were pulling by me, spitting on me, I'm thinking, I'm going to get so angry and so enraged, it's going to affect me and probably not allow me to be the kind of person I want to be. But yet that's not how your family reacted. So talk to me about Mom and Dad and how they helped you through that.
My parents were terrific folks who were God-fearing, loved the family, and believed in doing right by all folks. They were not quick to anger, and they cautioned us not to respond to any and every slight, because one could get you killed. But also, and this is a creed that came to a lot of African-American families, that in order for us to be successful, you're going to have to work twice as hard to end up at the same spot that your white counterparts are going to have to be. Work twice as hard, do due diligence, and understand you're going to be receiving a lot of indignity. That's all a part of that. And a lot of that message was either told verbatim or was implied, but it was, we just got the message. We also figured out that when things did happen, we didn't come home to our parents to and tell them that, because we also figured out pretty early on that they had no ability to counteract that this is just how things were. And so rather than put our parents in a position where they would appear helpless, we just didn't tell them that.
Sure.
So, and I found that was true with my cousins, many of them who were raised in the whole little section of Arbutus. Again, it was
your sister told us about this, right? And Don's uh-huh. West Side. I mean, I'm from the East Side, so Turner's speaker. I was going to call her agent, but Don gets mad when I don't use the right title.
Madam Speaker
told us. There's the Turners of the West Side. I think is kind of how she explained it, right?
Yeah, except a lot smaller. Catonsville had a larger African American population. In Winters Lane area, and then there was, the Cowdensville area. So that may, we may have had like about, I don't know, 20, 25 homes in, you know, the Cowdensville area. And at least one, two, three, four, five of the homes there were relatives. So, you know, so yeah, we all agree with that. I mean, it was a very close-knit group, like many folks during that era, that just about anybody on the street, if they were an adult, could discipline you, and you wouldn't dare embarrass, you know, your family or embarrass your community. So that really kept us in line, for one, you know, that it was just, you know, you don't want to embarrass your family. So
we heard that from Westmore. We heard that from Ben Jealous. The whole idea that it's cliche as it sounds, it was that it takes a village thing, but that everybody knew who little Barry was on the street, and he better not act like a goofball because the other neighbors were going to keep you in line as well, right?
Right, absolutely.
Takes a village. Absolutely. It takes a village. Well, hey,
heard that over and over. Hey, Barry, Nestor referenced your sister, the Speaker of the House, first African-American Speaker of the House in the state of Maryland. For those listening, I certainly watched, and I'm so proud of Adrian. I watched your family. Talk about that moment, that day, and what your thoughts were as your sister is sworn in.
Well, certainly a great deal of pride. I know how hard my sister works and how very focused she can be on doing things for the citizens of Maryland. Certainly, you know, she started off representing her own district, and, you know, now she's a statewide person. But I also, that we were a little saddened only in that we wish our parents could have been there because they would have been so proud. They would not have been able to have imagined that she would have attained, you know, such heights. Now, my grandfather, and Don, you probably know this as well, is the one who engaged Thurgood Marshall to sue Catonsville to integrate Catonsville. Now, what they wanted to do was, he didn't really expect it to be integrated, but he wanted to have a black high school for African-American kids, because in Baltimore County, up until 1939, black students were only provided an education in Baltimore County to the seventh grade. After that, then they had to take a test, and depending on how much money was in the coffers for education for black children, they set the bar higher or lower, but if you did well in the test, then you could, and there was plenty of money, then you could go into Baltimore City to either Douglas or Dunbar High School. My grandfather engaged Thurgood Marshall, and was his second case, and to try to bring a black high school in, but they wanted to do it by showing integration. So they tried to integrate. The principal's name at the time was Zimmerman, and so the case became Williams versus Zimmerman. They lost, and then they lost an appeal. So it was my father's oldest sister, Margaret, who my grandfather was trying to provide a high school education. So Baltimore County had to pay for her to go to St. Francis Academy. So fortunately, it ended up well. Fortunately, in 1939, you know, they had black high schools, or at least a curriculum, and a couple of buildings in Baltimore County so that black students could get a high school diploma. Well, so that's the kind of a legacy that I come from as well.
This is the history that so many don't know, and our dear friend Lewis Diggs has tried to capture so much of it in his work as he chronicled the historically African-American communities in Baltimore and Baltimore County and the richness of them. You know, as you're talking, Barry, about that experience, I've written about it before, and I think I'm getting ready to write about it again, but to think about what a short period of time there has been between these things that just don't even compute today. I've written that in 1968 at Bogger's Restaurant in Westminster, right down the hill from Western Maryland College, one of the
first people I ever met on the campus on day one, and we became lifelong friends till the day he died, was Prince George's County Executive Wayne Curry. And,
oh, sure, yeah.
You know, and Wayne and I became, I mean, you know, I'd go down to his house, he'd spend nights at my house. We became really good buddies. And early in our freshman year, we're sitting in Parker's restaurant, and we're sitting there, it's just Wayne and me, and everybody's getting served, and Wayne and I are sitting there, and everybody's getting served, and I'm going, Wayne, what the hell is going on? And he, mm-hmm. he looked at me, again, I think he gets us back to white privilege. Wayne Curry looks at me, and he, with that twinkle in his eye, and he goes, man, you don't get out much for a white boy, do you? And I go, what are you talking about? He goes, you know what's going on. And the bottom line was, in 1968, they were going to make sure that they sent a message that black people weren't welcome in this restaurant in Westminster.
Right.
That's 1968. I mean, just remarkable. And I think here we are today with thousands of people in the street. And the question that we've asked everyone, though, we keep having these vigils. We keep having these marches. We had them after Ferguson. We had them after Eric Garner. We had them after Trayvon Martin. Is this one different? Is this finally the one where America says, let's stop it? We can't do it anymore. Is this the one, Barry?
It feels that way to me, Don. You know, certainly I followed all of those incidents, you know, behind that. I'm wondering, you know, how much more is this going to happen? I mean, what more will it take before things change? And obviously it did not happen with Freddie Gray. And in spite of all the things, there not much really changed. But this one seems different. And it could be the impact of all of the cell phones and the cameras and things, and people are recording, you know, things, and you can't deny seeing things that, you know, and looking at the police account. And I am certainly, let me be very quickly say that I know this is not all police, but it's certainly been a kind of a tacit approval, and when people don't speak out. So, and if you're a policeman, and you have to know that people that are a part of your group that are conducting themselves in a way. But this seems different. People are more aware. And again, falling back to our earlier discussion about Colin Kaepernick, now it appears that more people are getting it. Now it appears that, okay, now we understand. You know, and they're not trying to dismiss the discussion and, you know, and reframe it to be about something else, because it isn't. It is about treating African Americans as full, equal human beings in this country.
Well, I tell you, Barry, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to sit down. As I said, these are real discussions. These are tough discussions. And we just encourage everybody in our audience to try to have them. Have them, you know, across the dinner table, across the backyard fence. Engage people. Let's not be afraid to talk about race. I mean, you and I have talked about race a million times over the years. You know, I can remember the day, Barry, a dear friend of ours, I remember like it was yesterday, the day of the OJ verdict. And, you know, my office as assistant superintendent for the school system was right there as you came in Greenwood. You remember it was right there to the right. Mm-hmm. Evelyn Jenkins had an office down the hall, and Evelyn's one of my closest friends to this day, and she was standing in my doorway as they announced the verdict, and they have that iconic video of where they cut to Howard University Law School, and those students are cheering. And I can remember, it's probably one of the most important conversations I've ever had, but I said to Evelyn Chapman, I said, Evelyn, you know, at that time, I don't know what I was, 40 years old, however, when the OJ...
25 years ago, do the math.
Yeah, that was 25 years ago?
Yeah.
I was 40 some years old. So I said to Evelyn,
I'm a 40-some-year-old white guy. You got to help walk me through this. And, of course, because she's Evelyn, she did. And we had this incredible conversation. But we don't have those conversations, do we, Barry?
No, we don't. We don't. It's interesting. On that very day of OJ, I was a principal at Randallstown High School. And fortunately, sometimes, you know, God allows you to have a little wisdom. And the faculty meeting that I had had on that Monday, that week, I had required all the teachers to have lesson plans available to have a discussion regardless of how the verdict was going to be. And I also had set up that those teachers who were not in classes, you would be in the hallway. So I had this whole framework set up. Little did I know that only like two days later that they were going to have the whole verdict. Well, Richard Scher from WJZ had contacted me and asked if he could come to the school. And I said, sure. This is before the verdict because he wanted to kind of get the reaction of the students. I really didn't know which way it was going to go. Fortunately, and this the selfish part of me said, fortunately, in a predominantly African-American school,
right. It
went the verdict the way it was because the kids cheered and white kids. We still had a smattering of white kids at Randallstown at that time. You know, they all cheered and things went well. You know, but I was prepared if it was going to go the other way, how to contain the kids. No one really knew at the time. But there were a lot of lessons, a lot of that still to be learned, a lot of discussions that, you know, I think that if people just kind of, you know, take the time and say, hey, listen, can we talk about this?
Well, what Evelyn was able to say to me that day, Barry, and I don't know, she walked me through, said, as hard as it is to understand, you're thinking it's a simple question of guilt or innocence. Did this man kill these people? Hmm. For the African-American community, it's so much of a bigger issue of years of distrust and being mistreated by law enforcement that it's not that simple. And when you begin to unpack it that way, it doesn't mean that I still draw the same conclusion as to whether OJ was guilty or not, but it does begin to open up a window as to, okay, now I think I understand it better.
Well, I was in a Cleveland bar, and, you know, it was in the morning, and it was half black, half white. It was downtown. Nobody was from there. They all just sort of piled in because that's where the TV was, you know. And I was at a hotel, and, you know, every black person cheered. Every white person hung their head and walked out and said, he's guilty. But And 25 years later, we have people marching through the streets here, right? Still, and so much of that trial that played out was black and white and cops and justice and all of that, right? And we're talking a lifetime ago now, 25 years, right?
A lifetime ago, and we're still having the same discussions, and you know, it's we're going to continue to have people, smart people like Barry on, who really willing to roll their sleeves up and get into these discussions and say it's not easy. We don't have all the answers, but we're willing to try to say let's keep working at it. Let's see if we can't become a better society.
Hey, appreciate both of you. Barry, always good to visit. I see you out on Facebook from time to time and linking in, and it was great to visit with your sister as well, who's doing a great job down in Annapolis. We appreciate
you,
your time,
Nestor.
Man.
Thank you.
Barry Williams joining us here along with former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller talking education. Get principals together, you start talking about Greenwood and Randallstown and Dundalk and all that good stuff, Catonsville. That's what Baltimore Positive's all about. You can find me, Nasty, at WNST.net anytime. Thankful for all of our sponsors, including our friends at Taharka Ice Cream, State Fair in Catonsville, Fadley's, shipping the crab cakes all over the world, and our friends at Moeller and Gary Realty. Jeff Moeller going to join me in a couple weeks. We're going to get together, talk some baseball, even though there is no baseball, which is... that's another story altogether. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. Towson, Baltimore. Keep them calm, staying local, and always Baltimore positive.